We dealt with biology, and today we want to deal with issues related to physics and chemistry. I'm not going to get into the equations and stuff, so don't worry. But just as when we talked about biology, we were tied up with the difficulty of writing a natural history. So I think in also the areas of physics and chemistry, we're also tied up in that difficulty. All these areas are related. Whether it's biology or dating systems and measuring ages, they're all still dealing with the same basic issue, and that is, how do we write a history of nature that has not been observed by humans? It's helpful if you keep that in mind so that when we look at these different areas, you don't lose the forest for the trees. And so what I'm doing here is I'm only giving you the broad outlines of the argument. But I assure you, if you get into all the details and you've thought this thing through, you'll realize that we're covering the argument quite intensively. So what I'm doing is I'm summarizing a vast amount of information, hundreds of hours of research, so that we're not going to deal with all that. We're just going to deal with the big picture. You can totally bury yourself in all the details, but I don't want you to miss the basic argument. Now today we're going to move into the area of physics and chemistry. And I thought we were going to look at the age of the earth and the age of the universe, but we don't have time to do both of those, so we'll leave the universe for next week. We'll just work on the earth this week. So when we come to physics and chemistry, it's an issue of the age of the earth. I want to introduce this the same way I introduced the biology realm. I want to introduce it with this diagram. You may be tired of it, yes, but we learn by repetition. And this is one of the most powerful ideas I've ever taught you. Do you realize that if you truly understand this chart, and it may take you some time to meditate upon it. Seriously, think about it. If you want one, I'll gladly give you one. But if you get it, okay, then you can go toe-to-toe with anyone, period. And they can never beat you. You've got them hands down, okay? And what that means is that you can press the gospel on people in a way that you've never been able to do before. Now, when you look at that chart, no matter who you are, no matter how educated you are, no matter how much experience you have, you have no direct knowledge outside of that box. None of you, period. Your professors don't. The greatest authors in history don't. The most brilliant people in the laboratory don't. All human experience is inside that box and not outside of it. Okay, that box is the limits of direct human observation in both space and time. You cannot experience anything, we would say, you know, faster than a fraction of a second. You cannot experience anything that exists beyond the average lifetime. You cannot see anything below a few fractions of a centimeter in size. And you cannot really observe anything in detail above a certain scale of size. And so that's your limits. So whatever your view of history is, you've got to contend with this problem. Now, so here, in a very graphic way, is finite, limited human knowledge. Now, we can extend our knowledge, we said, in three of the four directions, one, two, three, but you can't go to the right. So we can use instrumentation, right, the technology. We have high-speed film that enables us to slow down time so we can see things that the eye cannot normally see. It happens so rapidly. We can go down with the microscope and see things smaller. We can go up with the telescope and see things farther away. But there's one side of that box that's different than the other three. And don't ever forget that, because this is what modern man wants you to forget. You cannot extend your knowledge to the right by any known instrument of mankind. You cannot go back in time. The instrument we would need, of course, is the time machine, but we don't have one. So the only thing you can do to extend partially human observation is to look back at records that human beings have kept that lived before you. And that's the dark blue area here. The period of human observations and records that were made from those observations. But beyond that, there's no more direct observation. It's pure conjecture. It's pure speculation. So the question in writing a natural history boils down to this. Whether it's a biological history, a physical history, or a chemical history, the issue is how do you know what went on when you don't have human observations as to what went on? How do you do that? Well, how it's often done is to say that the rules of observations of data that we see inside the box hold outside of the box. Reasonable, right? After all, you know, what holds here you would expect to hold on the moon, on Jupiter, outside of the solar system in space. So why don't we just extrapolate physical and chemical laws that we've observed inside the box, outside of the box? What's the problem with that? Well, there's no problem, except that you have to admit that it is an extrapolation, that it is a speculation. That's the point. We aren't arguing that you can't produce a theory. Okay. We're not arguing that you shouldn't teach any kind of theory at all. All we're saying is that when you discuss this, at least be intellectually upfront about it and confess that you are, in fact, speculating. Not only are you speculating, but if you think of the fact that this limit is only a few thousand years of human observation, and you're going to come up with a natural history in which you're talking about billions of years, 10 to the 9th versus 10 to the 3rd worth of human observations, I don't know, but that sounds like a million-fold extrapolation to me. And what would you think if I took a piece of yarn and held it here and somebody took the end of that thread and walked out the door to the parking lot? And the distance of that thread might represent the amount of time that you're extrapolating, the billions and billions of years. Do you know how much data source that we would actually have? About 1/8 of an inch of that thread would be actual data that we have. Now let's back off, okay, and let's ask, what in the world are these people doing here? Okay, on the basis of 1/8 of an inch of observations, you're going to tell me what the thread is doing 40 yards out there in the parking lot? Excuse me, but that is not, okay, the hard science of the laboratory. If I can reproduce something in a laboratory, that's what we call hard science. I do it over and over and over. But when I start talking about something that's going on in the parking lot on a thread that I only have a data base of 1/8 of an inch along that thread, I don't have very much. And that's the central issue that's going on here in the dating game. The contention of the pagan mind is that it has the right to extrapolate outside that box. But the point is, once you get outside that box, by definition, you are outside the box of observational data. And you're speculating. It cannot be verified. Now let's talk about some of the dating theories. Now I'm not talking about male-female dating theories, although we'd want to keep that strictly in those categories. Now, you want to be aware that there are spiritual motives here. You don't want to get snookered, okay, when this question of the age thing comes up. You know, because we use the illustration, for example, you know, how many times did you beat your, last week, did you beat your wife? And you have to be careful about the questions you decide to answer and don't answer. You can't answer that question without incriminating yourself. And what has happened when I ask that kind of a question? See, what I've done is I've set it up for you. Now you're playing my game. I've drawn you into my agenda. And it's foolish to answer my question. So what we have to do as Christians is learn, yeah, okay, we're going to answer questions, all right, but we're not going to naively answer every question that someone asks us. Look, Jesus did not answer just any old question. You know, Pilate asked him at the trial, what is truth? A very sarcastic question. And did Jesus answer? No. I'm sure there are many other times when the great saints of Scripture refused to answer a question because it was a stupid question. In fact, Proverbs says this, do not answer a fool according to his folly. Don't answer him. It's stupid. Ask a stupid question, you don't necessarily give him an answer. Now that's what we want to do here. We want to think about what's going on and not just say, oh, this is an innocent, objective, mathematical question. Is it really, or is this question talking about the very structure of life itself? And if it's talking about the very structure of life itself, there are some spiritual factors that operate here, right? Gotta be. It's a part of the fabric of who we are. Because a pagan may believe this, ages and ages and ages things, but we know the pagan's heart better than the pagan knows his heart. What do we know about the pagan's heart from Romans 1? We know that he knows that God is there. We know that he's spending an enormous amount of energy suppressing the knowledge of God. So that's why I say the pagan insistence upon, that's why we say that the pagan insistence upon vast ages is not surprising to any Bible-believing student of paganism. Vast ages. What do vast ages accomplish for the carnal mind? What they do is they push back any creative work of God so far beyond the human horizon and sense of ethical responsibility to Him. That's what it does. A long chronology offers a spiritual relief to the rebellious heart. I want to repeat that. Very important. A long chronology offers spiritual relief to the rebellious heart. If any conceivable creation is too distant in the past to contemplate, then any judgment in the future would probably also be far too distant to worry about. See how the carnal mind operates? This was in the news last week. My secretary gave me the thing right off the internet about how long it's going to be before the universe ends. Well, if it's so far, we don't need to worry about it. Doesn't affect us. Now this isn't new. Long ages is not new at all. Remember when we studied Enuma Elish, the Babylonian piece of literature from the time of Moses, and I said learn to read your Bible and read it against the time in which it was written. So you read other literature at the same time Moses was written and you look at the differences. Well, right there in that document, there's a long ages phrase. It says, they lived many days, adding years to days. They lived many days, adding years to days. That's typical of pagan literature. It's a theme of pagan literature. Long, 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 long ages. The idea that the universe is forever. And that, we know, is a weakened form of one of the attributes of God. If the universe exists forever, what attribute of God are they then stealing and distorting a bit and placing it on the universe? Eternality. Only God is eternal, not God and the universe. So hopefully we're now sensitive to the fact that this is a spiritual issue. It's not just an intellectual issue. On the presuppositions of paganism, which we've seen here, modern paganism seeks to establish an autonomous base for knowledge independent of God. An illusion is thus created that seems to provide It seems to provide the necessary constants for mathematical calculations, everything we see in the box. Such constants or laws are then universalized throughout space and time, far beyond man's limited observation and experience. All measurements of past historical time builds upon such constants. They are hypothesized, for example, the speed of light and radioactive decay rates. So you see what's happening? They're expanding their knowledge outside of that box. But you can only expand the knowledge outside of that box by conjecture. Now why do you want to conjecture as a pagan? Why do you have to? Well, because obviously so you can have knowledge. So they generate what we call, what is called natural law. And again, let's think about the word natural law. What does that convey to you? What is the connotation when someone says natural law? It's a very, very important connotation. And what it carries, the connotation it carries, is that nature never changes. A law, well, that sounds so profound. Laws don't change, you know. But just think about it. Why do you call it a law? Why do you call it a law if there's no lawmaker? If you're a pagan, there's no lawmaker. Okay, the universe just is. So who makes natural law? Of course, we know. Yes, but on a pagan basis, just what are in the world are you talking about? How did it get there? How do you know what applies here and now applies everywhere else and every when else? How do you know that? Those are the questions you need to ask these people. Well, how do you know? Well, people just say, well, it's just natural law. Natural law, it's constant everywhere. But how do you know natural law applies way out there? In other words, what people do is they exercise their Adamic nature. We all do. We can't escape it. We want to have dominion. Genesis 1, thou shalt name, thou shalt name, thou shalt name. And here comes the pagan. He's exercising his dominion, and he's naming things. And he's named this conjecture out here after a legal metaphor. Natural law. And the thing just builds on itself, and everybody just talks today about natural law, natural law, natural law. But if you want to really throw a monkey wrench in a discussion sometime, just ask somebody, you know, I don't understand this natural law thing, you know. What do you mean? And play with that box a little bit with someone and see how far you can push it. Question someone. See if they can really get the point. That when you get outside that box, you can't be sure it's law because you can't go out there to check on it. Okay? Now, let's go through a little story here about three observers. We're going to do a thought experiment. What do we want to do is we want to all go back to the Garden of Eden. And we're going to talk about the creation of Adam. This story should illustrate the point about natural law one more time and where we stand as creationists. Let's say we have three observers. We'll call them Observer A, B, and C. Now, Observer A takes his time machine back, and he arrives in the Garden of Eden at, let's just say, 10 o'clock in the morning. And God is just then beginning to create Adam. And let's say, you know, here we are on the sixth day, and between 10 and 10:05, God is working the earth. He shapes the body of Adam just like a sculpture, just like an artist. He shapes this body with his divine hands. Then he blows into his nostrils the breath of life, and it becomes man, becomes Adam, just as the Bible says. Surprise, surprise, surprise. Wow, here we are. So Observer A is sitting there. And fortunately, he took his video camera with him. And his video camera has a little clock on it, like most of them do. And he's clocking. He's making a videotape of this whole thing. And the clock at the bottom of the picture is ticking away. 10 o'clock, 10:01, 10:02, 3, 4, 10:05. Okay, and he's finished his observation. He's just seen the creation of Adam. So he's got a 5-minute video of creation activity. Now, Observer B comes on the scene at 10:10. However, Observer B, he doesn't see Observer A over there. Observer B doesn't have any tools. Observer A has no idea, you know, that he's there. God is now gone. Okay, he's not there on the scene. But whatever Observer B sees as he walks into the garden is this man standing there, this Adam. Observer B looks at Adam. He says, you know, the guy, he's about 6 foot two. He's about 180 pounds, about, how old do you think he would have thought he was? I was about 25-year-old gentleman. Now think about that observation. Out of his experience, Observer B. Okay, think back. We said experience comes out of that box. Has Observer B, in his box of observation, ever observed a creation of a person to maturity in 5 minutes? No. What he has observed again and again and again to the point that he's convinced is natural law is that babies are born and then they grow over at a certain rate. So within his box, he says, there's a man, he appears to be about 25 years old. Now, Observer A, however, what would his answer be to how old Adam is? 5 minutes. That guy is 5 minutes old. Now, what are we going to do now about our dating systems? We've got two observers. Neither of them are consciously lying. Now, you can't say Observer B is consciously lying, can you? Is he going on the basis of his experience and what he's defined to be natural law? Yes. Well, why are we getting two different clock answers here? Two different ages. Does Adam look different to Observer A than he does to Observer B? No. Is the data set any different? No. They're both looking at the same thing. So the only difference is that Observer B, when he walked into the garden, he came late, so he didn't see the creation of Adam. He doesn't have access to the video camera because A and him don't see one another. What then, in effect, does he not have? Well, he does not have observational data of a historic event. So he has to go on the basis of an extrapolation. He has to extrapolate age on the basis of what he assumes to be constants. Now let's bring in the spiritual conflict that is there. I said this is not just intellectual. This is not just a mathematical scientific problem. This is a spiritual issue. At 10:10, from the other side of the garden, at the same time B came in, another observer came in. We'll call him Observer C. Observer C is taking his time machine. Of course, he's got his box like we all do. He understands the same thing that Observer B does. But Observer C has an additional quality. Observer C is a friend of A. And so Observer A sees him and walks over to him and says, hey, look, you got to see what I got on my video camera here. I was here. Look, I saw this. I took this 5 minutes ago. This was completed. So now Observer C has to decide. Does he trust Observer B or does he trust Observer A? And the question is, what would you do? And why? Put yourself in Observer C's position. You walked in late. You can't observe this video. This is past, I mean, you can observe the video, but you can't observe the original event yourself. This is past time. It's a historic event. So you're dealing with a historical question. You've got a guy on one hand who claims to have videoed this stuff with he's got a clock on it and everything. And you check out that clock and it's 10:10 and your watch reads the same as that video. Everything's checking out. Now, think about the process. If you think about that simple little story there, okay, that I just told you about the three observers, then you've got the chronology issue locked up. On what basis, if you are Observer C and you come in late, do you decide that question? Why would you, for example, agree with Observer B? What would you be doing if you if you did side with Observer B against the guy who's got the video camera, Observer A? To agree with B would mean that you put a higher confidence in extrapolated natural law than you do in eyewitness evidence. Witness that you can't get at because by definition you came in late. But someone else was there, and they show you an eyewitness evidence. Is this a little bit of reflection about what you believe about the integrity of Observer A? Without question. If Observer A has come forth and has told you, look, I took this record. Here is my camera. I'm not lying to you. I didn't have time. It's been 5 minutes ago. I didn't have time to put this thing together. Okay, this is what I got. Now, if you still side with observer B, what are you saying about the character of A? You're saying he's either deceitful, okay, or something went wrong with your camera, buddy. You know, you've been watching television or something somewhere else and taking that, but that couldn't have happened. So the questions, they get very involved. But you want to go back to the story time and time again every time you hear about the dating question, the age or whatever. The problem here is that when you are observer C and you walk in on the scene and you have to choose between A and B and you can't choose between them without going back to your basic presupposition of life. If you agree with B, your basic presupposition of life is that the universe could not possibly do that. What is on your camera is impossible. It's got to be a fake. Now, if you were observer A, how would you feel if he said that to you? You're observer A, and I'm observer C, and I'm not buying this stuff. My guy B had this guy over here. He's got it all together. I mean, what's wrong with you? I don't know how you got the film, but come on. This just cannot be. Now, as observer A, don't you feel slighted? For crying out loud, I was here. I filmed this thing. It went on right in front of my eyes. So, if you side with observer B, your presupposition is, okay, your worldview that you have to hold on to is that what goes on today in that box has always been and will always be. And that's exactly what Peter warned against in 2 Peter 3. He said, the pagan always says that all things continue just as they were since creation. There's no such thing as interruptions. There's no such thing as discontinuities. There's no such thing as miracles. And Peter said, therefore, these people deny the second advent of Christ too. That little interruption. Of course they do. It's very logically consistent. But if, on the other hand, you say, no, I agree with observer A, then what presupposition allows you to do that? What presupposition would allow you to agree with observer A over against observer B? What would you tell your friend B? You know, you look at the camera, you look at the clock, you look at Adam, and you say, I'm sorry, B, but something happened here. This must have happened. What you're saying is that you believe in the integrity of A. That story should summarize the principles that we're illustrating in clocks, dating methods. And we're going to spend the rest of the time on a set of clocks, several of the clocks that are used in dating. Okay, just to start off in this area, what does the Bible say about the age of the earth? People sometimes say it doesn't say anything about the age of the earth. Excuse me, but we have a lineage. There's from Adam to Jesus, recorded in three different places in Scripture. And we know that there's a connection. And we say, maybe there's gaps in the genealogy. Well, there may be gaps, but there's only so many gaps you can put in a genealogy before it ceases to be a genealogy. Henry Moore said, what do you put, 50,000 years between each of these guys? It's not a genealogy anymore. It's a list of people's names. So, let's say this forces a limit to the age in thousands of years. Let's say the argument of 6,000 years, something like that. Order of magnitude issue is serious here. We're talking thousands of years. Okay, what did we say about Genesis? We said when Adam was created, he's created on the sixth day, right? And we've only got 6 days here. Unless you want to try to make each day 1,000 years, but that's not going to help, right? Because you need a lot more than 1,000 years in there. You need billions of years in there. And then you've got to get the order right, because the order's all wrong. So it doesn't help to get 1 billion years in there either. So any kind of scriptural interpretation you deal with is going to be less than 10,000 years. It's impossible to get more than 10,000 years in the biblical text. It's just impossible. Anybody got a clue as to what the popular going bet is on the age of the earth right now? 4.5 billion years. Now we've got two different ages here. Slightly different. What do we have in the garden between observer A, B, and C? Didn't we have an order of magnitude problem there? 5 minutes versus 25 years. What's the difference? The difference is the same thing that happened to those three observers. What do we have in this book that is analogous to the video camera? We have a historical record. It's by the historical record, a record of what actually happened, written down by the observers, or those who investigated the observers. Now, who was the sole observer of the first five of the 6 days of creation? Adam wasn't there. It couldn't be him, right? He wasn't created till the sixth day. He's got a record from the time he woke up. But who told him about the stars? Who told him about the creation of the plants and the land and the water and the expanse and all the rest of it? God did. It had to come from God. Was he an observer of his own work? I hope so. We're worshiping the wrong God if he isn't. So we have a historical record. So you can see this really isn't a tremendous intellectual problem at all, is it? It's just the details, okay, that get kind of messy. But I think everyone should see now what the problem is. I think you see what the basic outline of today's lesson is all about. Let's look at some clocks. I'm going to go through some of the clocks that are mentioned in the literature. In the pagan view, of course, present-day observations fix the value of all time constants. Any supposed, you know, discontinuity, such as a creation or a flood, are totally ignored. And what is not usually mentioned is that even with this method, there are widely varying ages that result. Now, let's act like pagans. I mean, just intellectually. Let's assume we believe in natural law, okay? Everything that we observe fits everywhere else in the universe all the time, forever. And we can make all these extrapolations from that. So I'm not saying these are dates are correct that I'm going to show you. I'm just saying that if you want to play the natural law game, I'll play with you and I'll show you that on the basis of natural law, that in fact the clocks don't agree. They should agree, but they don't agree with one another. We're not getting the same date off all the clocks. So let's explain several of these. These are locally verifiable. That means you yourself can go out, and if you get the right instruments, you can check these yourself. Right now, today, inside your box of observation. And then you can extrapolate that clock back and ask yourself, okay, when was T sub zero? When did this thing start? And here is the date you get. Now, let's just look at the variation, okay? None of which, and I didn't ever get to the continent erosion rates, but it's far less, but I couldn't find the data a little bit later. I didn't have time to get to it. But it's far less than 4.5 billion years. So let's go through these. The recorded history of man itself is kind of an indication. If man lived for millions of years, okay, millions, and where are all the records? What suddenly happens is that we don't have any more records before 3000 BC. You just go back and that's it. Has anybody ever asked why all of a sudden you have historical evidences? Before that, you didn't have nothing? I mean, what? Man one day is walking along, can't find his banana, the next day he's writing and talking? Population growth, first one. Right. This is a ripper. This is really easy to understand. Do you know how we can tell the population rate, growth rate of the earth? Well, we've got a subset of human beings called Jews, incidentally. Now, when was the first Jew? We know who he was, don't we? It was Abraham. He lived about, 2,000 years before Christ. So what do? You take the population of the Jews today on planet Earth, and you work backwards to Abraham in 2,000 B.C. So that's 4,000 years. Every Jew came out of Abraham. And you've got built-in corrections for your clock, okay? It's a very conservative clock because this is a people that's had mass genocides numerous times in history. So we're talking about very, very conservative numbers here. This is not going to be a massive overestimate of growth rate. Now, if you can get all the Jews that now live out of one man in 4,000 years, and you apply that same growth rate just to the world population in general and work backwards, you get no greater than 9,000 years for the age of the earth, for human beings at least. If it was more than that, okay, more than 9,000 years, okay, evolution claims man has been around for approximately 1 billion years, okay? If you do that, you'd have people stacked on this planet five people deep. Okay, now where in the world are all the people? If we say, well, humans have been around for 1 billion years, and you apply a human growth rate of 0.01%, 0.01%, that is where you double the population only once every 7,000 years. We know we're doubling it a lot faster than that today. We double it, what, every 40 or 50 years? Okay? Let's say we double the Earth's population only once every 7,000 years, there would be 10 to the 43rd power people today. That's a one with 43 zeros after it. Now, this number is so big that Texans don't even have a word for it yet. Okay. So that limits it to less than 9,000 years. Another one is the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. We've got a field around the Earth that protects us from certain radiation that comes from the sun. And this is a subtle one, but very important. The Earth's magnetic field has been recorded from early in the 19th century, about 1829 or so. They started measuring it. And the interesting thing is that they're finding is that the strength of the Earth's magnetic field is decreasing. Thomas Barnes points out that if that's so, then if you take the rate of decay of the Earth's magnetic field and go back in history, then it must have been stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And if you make the Earth's magnetic field too strong, then the Earth's magnetic field has to be like a star to support it. And so you have an upper limit there of less than 10,000 years. It's just not possible. Carbon-14, this is an interesting one, always in the media, right? It deals with living organisms. It does not deal with rocks. If anybody ever says this carbon dating dated this rock to be this old, they're lying through their teeth because carbon dating doesn't have anything to do with rocks. It has to do with living organisms that breathe. Through measurements, they say you can use carbon-14 decay rate to go back to approximately about 60,000 years. Now, what they have to know to do this and to get accurate dates is that carbon-14 and carbon-12 are in equilibrium. That is, they're not changing. The amount of carbon-14 compared proportionally to carbon-12 must be the same. But in all the dates you see, in Time magazine, CNN, whatever, popular science, Nature, all the big journals, they all assume that carbon-14 and carbon-12 are in equilibrium. But scientists since the 1960s have known that it is not in equilibrium. We are having an influx of carbon-14 into the atmosphere at a rate of 25% higher than carbon-12. And if that's the case, then you can forget it. You're going to get much greater numbers than reality if you do that. So you have to have an equilibrium of carbon-14, carbon-12. That is the fundamental basis of the whole argument. So what that means is we don't know how much carbon-14 was in an organism when it died compared to carbon-12. And that means we don't know how old these organisms are. At present, net influx rates of 25%. Now here's the argument we can make. If carbon-14 is increasing in our atmosphere by a rate of 25%, which it is, you can go out and measure it right now, then it would take 30,000 years for carbon-14 and carbon-12 to be in equilibrium. But they're not. So the implication is that the Earth must be less than 30,000 years max. You know, so we use carbon-14 in our favor. It teaches a young Earth. Okay, the helium content of the atmosphere. This is another one. If the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, there should be a lot more helium in the atmosphere than we have today. Present rates of increase indicate that the Earth is orders of magnitude younger than 4 billion years. And we're not arguing that these dates are right, but helium increase says 1.8 million years is the cap. It's the top. It's the max. That's not even close to 4.5 billion. Not even close. So I'm not saying that's the right age. I'm just saying, which clock is right? Which one gives us the real age of the earth? Continental erosion, or the rate of erosion of the continents. Obviously, the continents are eroding. You have rain, washes off the continents, takes the dirt and minerals with it, right? And you can measure the rate of that. Now, the continents then would have been washed away a long, 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 long time ago. We wouldn't have any continents, okay? They can only be around for about 1 million years, not 4 billion. The cooling of the Earth's surface. This is a cute one. You know who invented this argument? This was Lord Kelvin in the 19th century, who argued against Darwin and Huxley, Darwin's PR guy. And Kelvin worked with heat transfer equations, and he showed that the Earth is losing heat, okay? You know, we got this core, right? And the core is losing heat. So much heat it's losing that that you can't explain the warmth of the interior if the age is 4.5 billion. In other words, the Earth would have cooled and cooled and cooled. It'd be a cold place. We wouldn't have any warmth inside the core of our Earth. There wouldn't be any life here either. Okay, so he said the maximum age has to be no greater than 24 million. And that's far less than what is needed by evolutionists. Here's another one that's interesting, the salinity of the Earth's oceans. At present, far more salts enter the ocean each year than are removed. At present rates of influx, one evolutionist estimates, now this is evolutionary estimates, that the seas cannot be any older than 80 to 90 million years. That's the evolutionary statement. But I thought life evolved in the oceans 3 billion years ago. That's the evolutionary story. But their maxims are saying there wasn't an ocean, or the salinity wasn't right to create life. So let's suppose our oceans had been around for 3 billion years. How much salt content would we have today? It'd be like the Dead Sea all over Earth. Wouldn't be any life in there, period. It's not possible. So these are just some of the arguments, and I'll give you these because these are secure arguments. There are bad creationist arguments. I don't encourage you to use bad creation arguments. I encourage you to use good creationist arguments. We need to have integrity in the arguments we use. And there are some bad ones, so if you have questions, just ask me and I'll let you know. So, but the point is that these arguments about the clock system aren't so quite cut and dried as people would make you believe through the media. Now, I'm going to conclude class with showing you a rather spectacular case that came up in a court trial in Arkansas. The Evolutionary Party saw this argument. They could not answer it. It hasn't answered it since. This has been a long time now, about 20 years. And on the witness stand was Dr. Brent Dalrymple. He won the National Medal of Science. He's authored several books about the ancient age of the earth, the old age of the earth. And he was so offended that one of the Christian physicists brought this up in the trial that he said, it's just a tiny mystery that we cannot explain. All right, well, let's see this so-called tiny mystery. There's a rather exciting implication of this tiny mystery. Now, both these three little circles here are dyed sections. These are dyed sections of granite rock under a microscope. Okay, the man who studied this first probably knows more about this than any living person. The man who originated this was a guy named was a Canadian a long time back, and the guy who picked up his research was a man named Dr. Robert Gentry, and he went ahead and he developed the work. But you see a three-ring pattern there, right? He found this in the bedrock granite of the earth. So whatever we observe by way of history in that rock, we're not talking about the sedimentary rock on top, okay? We're talking about the bedrock of our planet. And what Gentry and these other guys notice is that if you slice the granite very, very, very thin, they call these slices mica, and then you can give it some dye and you see these strange ring patterns. We find these all over the world, okay? This is not an isolated case. What causes those rings? Well, it turns out that what causes those rings is radioactive decay. And at the core of those circles was the element that decayed. And when that element decayed by radioactive decay, it emits radiation. It emitted radiation. And those circles are the burn marks left by the radiation of those elements when they decay. It also turns out that we can tell what those elements are by measuring the diameter of those circles, you know, across, or the radius, either way. So these are actually three-dimensional spheres, but we're looking at a slice, so you see it in the planar, of course. But if we didn't slice it, it would be spherical. At the center, you have the element that's decaying. It radiates energy out, and as it decays in certain stages, the energy leaves these outer rings in its distinctive pattern. Now, this is polonium-218, okay? On your periodic table, you'll find polonium. This has got 218 as the atomic mass. Polonium-218 has been the identifying element at the center of these pictures because we know the diameter and all that stuff. What's significant about them is the half-life of polonium-218. 3 minutes. Very, very short for a half-life. Half-life means the existing time period for that element. In other words, polonium only exists for 3 minutes, and then it decays into another element. So it exists for a very small window of time. And the question is, when did it get in the granite? You could say, well, maybe polonium-218 came from a previous element that decayed that had millions of years of life as its half-life. And then it came to polonium, and then boom, that lasted for 3 minutes, and then it decayed into something else, and it caught it there in the rock. Well, you could explain it that way, except for one problem. In this case, in all these granite cases, there's no precursor to polonium-218. There's no previous element. If there were, we would see the decay rings of the previous element, but we don't see them. So what that means is that there is no parent element. It was just started as polonium-218. So you can't use that. I hope you see now where I'm headed with this. It's a rather astounding conclusion. Here's the point. What do we usually get in our evolutionary textbooks about the Earth when it was first formed? Was it a solid or was it a molten blob? It was a molten blob for millions and millions and billions of years, okay, till it cooled and crystallized. Now, would this granite then have been crystallized when the Earth was first formed? No. It would have taken millions of years to cool down to the point where it could crystallize and you could get these micas out of the granite. Now, the problem is, how do you preserve polonium-218 from decaying if it's got to wait until the Earth is all cooled down and crystallized before it can decay and leave the burn marks? So you've got a problem here. Either way you go, you can argue that radioactive decay didn't start until some other time. You know, radioactive decay just started late, recently, just started doing that. In which case, now you've got a denial of the radioactive decay constant. And then you're saying it's not constant. And it's just a variable. Or it is a constant, and what we're observing is the fingerprints of God at creation. The day that God created the earth, God instantly created it. And within the first 3 minutes, the decay of polonium happened. And it was captured in the granite base of our earth. In which case now, the earth does not fit the evolutionary model at all, where the earth was originally a molten blob for millions and millions and millions of years. Now, to argue against this, obviously, this is extremely troublesome to evolutionists. It's been around for 20 years and nobody's ever answered it. They tried. So what they tried to do is to poke holes in this argument is to say that polonium dissolved in water and it worked its way down into the granite so that you wouldn't see the parent element's decay rings. And it dissolved in water, went down in the rock. This happens sometimes, called leaching. And then it decayed. Does anybody see a problem with that? Let's just suppose it happened, okay? Let's suppose they did leach into that position. What did we say the half-life was? 3 minutes. What did it leach in there in 30 seconds? You know, and get all in place and then decay? All over the world? Or, if it did leach and took its time leaching, you know, it took some time to get there, which is typical, then you wouldn't see these nice rings. You'd see a streak as it leached, it decayed. But there are no streaks. We don't find streaks. We just find circles. So how do you explain that one? Well, they don't have an explanation. It's just a tiny mystery. So here is how evidence is handled. You see, they can talk about evidence all they want to until we creationists like to bring in this evidence. And then all of a sudden it's excused as, you know, just tiny mysteries. Dr. Gentry's thanks that he got for all this work that he'd done, okay, was that his fellowship money dried up from the National Science Foundation. After that, after he testified at that trial. Now, we're all open-minded, of course, in this country. Freedom of speech, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? This would be, okay, so we have the billion-year view. Here you have all the universe. You have the Big Bang happening, and the stars form, the supernova, the solar nebula, the Earth forms, blah, blah, blah. You would have all this natural activity gone by the time the Earth solidified. 4.5 billion years, Precambrian granites. They formed after all this activity had gone away. Well, that can't be. That's why Gentry points out that what we have here is the chemical elements that were spoken into existence by God. And the primordial polonium radio halos are extinct natural radioactivity that reduces this time period, you know, obviously it's got to be less than 3 minutes. Either you accept that, or you must deny the fact that radioactive decay is a constant. There's no other way around it. Either it's not a constant, and God created the world, or it is a constant, and you have no explanation for this data. You're just living in an imagination world. The funny part was, all the research, not the conclusions for the research, but all the research that he had done had been sponsored by the National Science Foundation, funded and peer-reviewed. Peer-reviewed before they realized, uh-oh, before we review this, we've got to watch what we've just done. We've just opened Pandora's box with this guy. Of course, they cut the funds off now so he can't do any more of his research. He's reduced to doing it in his wife's kitchen sink on Saturdays. A man who knows more about primordial radio halos than any other living person on Earth has to do his research in his wife's kitchen sink? Because we've got an agenda and we're not going to let that be touched. The other side, I tell you this story because this is real. This is the battle that we are in. The other side is not going to bow the knee. And they are going to fight us in every area they can fight us. Okay. And we have to stand up straight. And you cannot act like a doormat in this battle and just let people run over you. This is a spiritual battle. All right, so we've argued about a young Earth, instant creation of the Earth. Next time, we're going to look at the age of the universe, starlight, and those kinds of things.